The next case is number 06-2631, the United States against Dilworth.
Reed Cornea for Alto Dilworth. May it please the court, counsel. Mr. Dilworth has a number of concerns in this case, and they're all fairly interwoven. And I'd like to start with the first, and that is the application guidelines to his case as a whole. And this is kind of undergirding all of his concerns. Now, there are two ways of reading Booker. A minority of the circuits have approached the guidelines as consultative, that is, to be used in conjunction with 18 U.S.C. 3553A. Majority of the circuits, including the Seventh Circuit, have given the guidelines what I would term substantial weight, meaning you look at the guidelines, and if they're reasonable, that's it. Don't worry about 3553A. Unfortunately, what this means in practice is that district courts are treating the guidelines as presumptive and thus mandatory, and in turn violating defendants' constitutional rights. And this ties directly into Mr. Dilworth's concerns regarding relevant conduct. And his case is a perfect example of why the substantial weight approach just doesn't work. First, I'll start with the PSR report. Probation and parole felt it unnecessary to include a recommendation based on 3553A. All they did was calculate the guideline range and provide some background information on Mr. Dilworth. It is not beyond their ability to provide a sentence recommendation under 3553A. State probation officers in Wisconsin who are under a much, much, much heavier caseload managed to do that, looking at the severity of the offense, character of the offender, and need to protect the public. Now, in reaching this guideline range by the probation and parole, they relied on relevant conduct. And this, again, is a classic example of the dangers of relevant conduct. Now, probation and parole, in determining that conduct, looked at a statements from a known drug dealer and use those statements to calculate an approximate weight of around 500 grams of heroin. Unfortunately, this informant was killed in a home invasion where he was seeking to steal money and drugs. There was three people involved. Two of the home invaders were killed, and this informant's girlfriend, Erin Van Epps, managed to escape with her life.
And that's your problem. Because the court found that her testimony was credible up to and actually exceeding sales of 300 kilograms of marijuana equivalent.
And here's my concerns about that, Your Honor. On the stand, on cross-examination, she admitted to lying to protect her own self-interest. All right? Now, and beyond that, she had every reason to lie on the stand. Here, she was facing a serious, serious case that involved the death of two individuals. She has other drug cases involved where she's been facing conviction for distribution of heroin and other drugs. And I got to tell you, I don't know how often I've heard the government or courts say about witnesses the defendant puts on the stand, they have a reason to lie. They're protecting their family, they're protecting their son, they're protecting their daughter.
Of course, these arguments were made to the trial court.
They were.
And the court has to make the credibility define.
And
the court made that finding, and unfortunately it wasn't in your client's favor. And the court was aware of all that.
And what concerns me about that is, again, that the finding was based on a probable cause, and the guidelines in this case, preponderance of evidence, and the guidelines in this case were being treated mandatorily.
Yep, but you see...
And therefore his Sixth Amendment right was being violated.
You see, not only did the court find that Van Epp's statements were plausible... they were corroborated by that statement of Shepard before, he was killed, and the recorded phone conversation between Shepard and Dilworth that was prior to the sale that led to his December arrest, which the judge found showed that the two had a previous relationship that involved drug sales. I mean, your mountain is so high to climb here.
It is, Your Honor. It is. And I don't disagree with that. But I do feel very strongly that this kind of relevant conduct and the reliance on these kind of individuals, individuals who are seeking to protect their own interest, should be considered reviewed at a much higher standard than a preponderance of evidence. And that this was the concern of the Supreme Court in Booker. Here we are enhancing an individual sentence from approximately, if we looked at the weight that, taking the guidelines as they are, if we look at the weight that he was caught with, so to speak, and compare that to what his ultimate sentence, we're going from 18 months to 57 months. I mean, that's the amount of time that violent criminals are getting in prison. This is a first offender. He had a little run-in with the law back in the early 90s when he was a passenger in a vehicle. This was in Chicago, did the equivalence of a drug court and had that dismissed. The guidelines focus strictly on the severity of the offense, ignoring any of the other factors that need to be considered. This is a case that I strongly believe, and I think Mr. Dillard believes as well, that he should have done 18 months of incarceration. And what also concerns me about the credibility of the judge's finding the credibility of the witness is the fact that at the hearing, she took the weight down from 500 to 300 grams. So obviously she had some concerns about the credibility of the witness and the credibility of Mr. Shepard, yet still found enough to say that she was credible. So she's kind of credible, maybe credible, credible enough to give him 300 grams of heroin.
You know, actually, Judge Crabb rejected the guidelines calculation that was recommended in the PSR. That was 70 to 87 months, wasn't it?
And that was based on the 500 gram level that probation pro
right.
calculated.
And she arrived, at the lower range.
She did.
I mean, some might think that this was a generous sentence.
And some
when
might
you
think
said
that,
where, you know, where we're sitting.
Some might think that.
You hear about
and
a 48-year sentence for a, I mean, Mike, you know.
Certainly. And I think
see, it's your bad luck to be here on that day.
Yeah, sometimes that happens. I see that my time for rebuttal is now going, so I'll reserve that and come back. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cornea. We'll hear now from Mr. Ching. Please.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Meredith Dushman, and I represent, the United States in this case. Obviously, since Booker, this court reviews the sentence imposed by the district court for reasonableness. And here, the defendant got a sentence at the bottom of the advisory guideline range. But nevertheless, the defendant contends that the sentence was unreasonable and focuses on four primary concerns. He says the sentence was unfair because he is a first offender. Now, it's true. He is a first offender in the sense that this was his first criminal conviction. And, that was factored into the guideline range of his criminal history category 1. And, in fact, the court specifically referenced the fact that he was a first offender in sentencing him. Court clearly considered that as a factor, not as much as the defendant would have liked, but you can't say the court didn't consider it. But the court also considered the flip side of that because it wasn't really his first brush with drug dealing. And I think that the court appropriately focused a significant amount of time in the sentencing, focusing on what happened in March of 2005 in addition to what happened in December of 2005. In March of 2005, the defendant was found with heroin. He admitted he was going to distribute it. The police said, all right, well, we'll let you go. Gave him a pass. And instead of that being a wake-up call to him, he continues to deal and is finally then indicted after a December 05 buy bust, in which he's found with heroin and crack cocaine. So I think the court appropriately considered the fact that although a first offender, the defendant didn't seem to be easily deterred by law enforcement involvement, and she appropriately factored that into his sentence. The second concern is that the pre-sentence report and the way the pre-sentence report is done makes the guidelines mandatory. I wholeheartedly disagree that this circuit is just simply abandoning the 3553A factors. Mr. Cornea seems to argue that because the pre-sentence report doesn't have a separate section analyzing the 3553A factors, that somehow creates a mandatory guideline range. But the argument ignores the purpose of the pre-sentence report and the practical reality of how it's used. The pre-sentence report is used to gather facts. The court is the one that makes the ultimate decision.
Pause there and look at what the court did for a minute, Ms. Ducham. If we could pause for a minute,
sure,
and just take a look at what the court did as opposed to the PSR.
Sure.
I was somewhat disturbed by the court's handling of the matter. I didn't think that the district court really demonstrated any awareness of the 3553 factors. Seemed to treat this as a guidelines case. Did I miss something in the record? Is there something in the record that shows that the district court really did consider the 3553?
Yes, and I think that the court spent a significant amount of time especially focusing on this first offender notion, which of course was the defendant's strongest mitigating argument he had. The court spent a lot of time saying, I understand that you've been, you know, crime-free. I understand that the excuse you're giving the court is that you had your tools stolen and that you felt that you were in dire economic straits. I understand that, and I understand that by all accounts you seem to be a good father and you tried to provide for your family. All of those things are mitigating factors under 3553A. But she said, at the end of the day, I don't think those factors are enough to take you outside the lowest end of the advisory guideline range, as Your Honor already pointed out, was already lowered for him at sentencing from the original base offense level 28. So I do think, actually, that Judge Krabs spent a significant amount of time on the 3553A factors and was really sort of trying to reach out to the defendant and explain to him why it was that despite his mitigating factor, she was still felt that he deserved a sentence within the advisory guideline range, albeit the low end. Of course, ultimately, you know, going back to this idea that the pre-sentence writer is crafting the sentence and that makes it mandatory, ultimately, as this case is a perfect example, it's the judge's decision as to what to do with the facts set forth in the PSR and what factors to weigh and what exactly the guideline range should be. In fact, the pre-sentence writer doesn't really have the authority to make a final say as to weighing the 3553A factor. So the fact that they don't specifically have a section in the pre-sentence report that says, you know, gee, how should the court apply the 3553A factors is really relevant. The defendant also claims that this provision of 3553A, which says that the court should give a sentence not greater than necessary, limits the court's discretion, and that if the defendant can name a lower sentence that might be reasonable, then this court is obligated to order the district court to impose that. Well, that, of course, wrongfully assumes that this court has de novo review over sentences, and I think it flip-flops the entire role of the district court versus the sentencing court. If a defendant can come in here and say, well, gee, I think I could have got a lower sentence and it would have been reasonable, that just flip-flops the role of appellate review. And I think it also ignores the warnings of this court in prior cases that defendants should not confuse debatable sentences with unreasonable ones. And as long as the sentence imposed was reasonable, the existence of an alternative sentence is irrelevant. Finally, the court focused much of its questions about this issue with relevant conduct and especially the issue of the quantity. This is raised a little bit differently in the defendant's brief because he doesn't really make a challenge specifically to the range and how it was calculated. He sort of folds it into an argument that it should, the way it was calculated, should be more of a mitigating factor under 3553A, and so that's sort of how the government responded to it. But either way you look at it, the court acted absolutely appropriately. I don't need to repeat some of the things that that your honors have already gone over. But very briefly, you know, the court made a credibility determination that she was credible. She testified that her recollection was that in March of 05, she started buying heroin from him. And in fact, he submitted actually a letter to the court saying that he started distributing heroin in March of 05. And in fact, we know that because March of 05 is when they caught him first with heroin. So the March of 05 to December of 05 is the relevant time frame. It's corroborated by all of the other evidence in the case, including recorded phone calls with the defendant, which were introduced. And, you know, ultimately, also this argument that the court improperly used the CI statement, if you actually go back and look at what the court ruled on, the court didn't even take that really into consideration. This unnamed CI. Now, the dead guy, she definitely used his statements because his statements were corroborated because they were recorded. But this unnamed CI in the pre-sentence report was not really used by the court. But in any event, I think significantly the court found that even if you take defendant's statements and objections that he didn't meet the guy till July of 05, he would still be within the range that the court set. So, you know, even if you put aside all of the defendant's objections and you say, okay, so we'll take your word for it that you didn't meet him till July of 05, it's still within the range that the court set. And I don't think the finding was error, and I certainly don't think the court was required to count the way it handled the objections as some kind of mitigating factor under 3553A because the court did exactly what it was supposed to do. All in all, this was a reasonable sentence, and we'd ask you to affirm the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tuchman. How much time does Mr. Cornea have? He has 2 minutes.
Thank you. What we're arguing here for is that the guidelines be treated as consultative, that 3553A factors be looked at first, as is outlined in Booker, and that the guidelines then be looked at. I have great concerns with the term reasonable. I look at the history of that use by the courts, and reasonable seems to me to mean the status quo. Now, the telephone conversation, it was one telephone conversation, and it was on the date that the arrest took place. From my viewing of it, makes no indication that there was a long-term relationship. Obviously, some indication that there was a relationship, but that was never denied. I thought it was important that we know about the CI who the judge used to corroborate the testimony of Van Epps and the statements of Mr. Shepard, because as I think we just demonstrated at sentencing, a lot of what Van Epps and Shepard had to say was factually incorrect and just statements made to cover their own hind ends. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cornea. Mr. Cornea, you took this case by appointment of the court and have the thanks of the court for your representation of your client. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement. Against